All right. So our topic for tonight is 10 days of war and the second truce. So last time we discussed that there had been 4 weeks of warfare after the Arab invasion of Eretz Israel, and there had been 4 weeks of a truce. So between May 15th and roughly June 11th, there was fighting. And from June 11th through July 8th, there was a UN-imposed ceasefire, which was used to good effect by Israel to grow the IDF in terms of manpower and to increase its military capability and its weapons, its armaments. So the question really would be, when the 4 weeks are over, would there be an interest in prolonging the ceasefire and having peace be, or something akin to peace, be a more permanent feature of life in the Middle East? Or were the two parties going to go back to killing each other at each other's throats? So from the perspective of the Israelis, there was very much an interest in going back to war, that the attainments that had been secured in the 4 weeks of fighting were good, but were not nearly enough, and the situation was very precarious. Further territorial gains were necessary. But from the Arab point of view, you could think that they would be not so interested in going back to war, since they had already secured for themselves territorial expansionism into what had been British Mandate Palestine. But as is often the case in the Arab world, rational considerations are sometimes overshadowed by nationalistic zeal and fervor, especially after it has been ramped up with propaganda for the masses. And so the Arab regimes would have been risking their necks, risking their lives, to say after a limited war, which was inconclusive and did not destroy Zionism, that we're throwing up our hands and walking away. They had to, for their own nationalistic pride, keep up the good fight, or at least give the appearance of doing so. Now, Egypt began the fighting by cheating a little bit, and on July 8th, a day before the ceasefire was set to expire, they had some military maneuvers and shot a few rounds of artillery. Israel went on the offensive on all three sectors on July 9th, and the IDF wanted a decisive victory, which would bring a quick end to the war. Why is Israel interested in a quick end to the war? Well, very simply, because Israel can't afford to sustain mobilization of its forces, which is 10% of its population, for a prolonged period of time. You just can't survive as a country doing that. So they had to hope for victory, and quick victory at that. Okay, but quick victory was not to be attained. For those of you who are familiar with the history of the war, you'll know that this is not going to be our last session. It lasted a lot longer than 10 more days. Okay. Instead, it would drag on for another 6 months. Israel and Ben-Gurion were in a very belligerent mood. Ben-Gurion wanted to bomb Arab capitals. Why did he want to do this? Well, in part because he was agitated over what happened at Latrun and was itching for a symbolic victory of sorts, but also he was looking to assert his own authority after having experienced another round of a general's revolt. You remember we spoke in the last few weeks about the general's revolt, that the IDF emerged from the Haganah and the Palmach. But whereas the Haganah and Palmach were largely dominated by members of the Mapam party, the far left, essentially Marxist party, Ben-Gurion's Mapai party wanted their own stamp on the army in formation, so that Tzva Haganah Yisrael should be a real army along the lines of Western armies that had fought World War II. And he wanted to appoint certain people who had fought in the British army during the war and have them replace these Haganah riffraff commanders. And so he wanted guys like Mordechai Maklef and Shlomo Shamir rather than the likes of Yigal Alon. So in early July, in fact, on July 6th, 2 days or 3 days before the expiration of the ceasefire, Yigal Yadin, who was basically running the army, was head of operations and functionally the chief of staff of the army, threatened to resign unless Ben-Gurion gave up his quest for absolute control over the course of the war and all the appointments. What does Ben-Gurion do when faced with a revolt from his generals? He threatens to resign. And as I mentioned last week, the Haganah and IDF leadership, although they were afraid to be under Ben-Gurion's thumb in absolute terms, they were even more afraid to be without Ben-Gurion. He was such a dominating and domineering figure that they feared his threats to resign. Whether they were a bluff or they were real, who knows? But the bottom line is, effectively, they capitulated and Ben-Gurion got whatever he wanted. But his feathers had been a little bit ruffled, and he was forced to appoint Yigal Alon as a central front commander. Okay. Now, during the 10 days of war, which would last between July 9th and July 18th, there was no inter-Arab cooperation. This is a very important point. Remember, in the War of Independence, Israel and the Israelis feared for their very survival on the premise that if the Arabs were able to assemble a coalition that actually were able to work together and combine their resources and put all their firepower into the field, that there was a good chance the Jews would all die, and that Israel would not come into existence or not be sustained. As it turned out, the Arab states were not able to effectively form a coalition that really acted in concert. This was not the case in the first 4 weeks, and it was certainly not the case in the second round of fighting, the 10 days. But rather, each country was left to its own devices and on its own, with its own agenda. What did Israel do? Well, in the south, it was Operation Anfar, Mivtza Anfar. What is Mivtza Anfar? Well, Operation Anti-Farouk, that Farouk, King Farouk, is the king of Egypt, and Anfar means anti-Farouk. The goal was, long term, to expel the Egyptians from the country completely. However, in the more short term, the goal was to restore the link between the main body of the Jewish state along the coastal plain, the Tel Aviv area, and the enclave of Jewish settlements in the northern Negev, which had been separated by a column of Egyptian forces early in the war. So the goal was to break through that column of Egyptians and once again link up with the 20-some-odd Jewish settlements in the Negev. The other thing that Israel wanted to do was to destroy the supply lines and sever the connection between the eastern, northeasterly thrust of the Egyptian invasion and the northwesterly thrust. If you recall, the Egyptians went up the coastal road from Gaza, well, from Rafah to Gaza to Ashkelon to Ashdod. And Ashdod is not far from Tel Aviv, 20 miles away. But there was another wing of the Egyptian invasion that went northeast through Hebron, Beit Lechem, and all the way up as far as southern Jerusalem. So the goal of Operation Anfar was, yes, to rescue or to save the link with the Jewish settlements in the south, but also to make sure that the Egyptians are cut off and are stuck on enemy territory without supplies. Okay. So what did the Egyptians do during the four-week break when they were on vacation from the war to get them ready for the next round of fighting? Well, the answer is they didn't do all that much. In fact, they were busy just joking around and eating meals. And Nasser, who would go on to become the president of Egypt and who was at the Fallujah pocket on the road connecting the two branches of the Egyptian invasion, he wasn't busy preparing for more combat. He was busy recruiting soldiers for the Free Officer Corps coup, which in 1952 would depose King Farouk and send him off packing to Italy and take control of the country, which they would have until basically now. Other than when the Muslim Brotherhood took over a little bit in the Arab Spring. But basically Nasser, followed by Sadat, followed by Hosni Mubarak, followed by al-Sisi nowadays, a third, fourth generation of it. So he was busy just with this mishigas politically, and they were not serious about getting their soldiers ready. So what ended up happening? It was a battle. The Battle of Negba was like the Battle of Stalingrad, in the sense that Negba, Kibbutz Negba, was able to hold out against far superior enemy forces. Kibbutz Negba lost 5 people, and the Egyptians suffered between 200 and 300 dead. So the Egyptians are not doing well in this round of fighting. Between July 16th and July 18th was Mivtza Mavet LaPolshim. What does Mivtza Mavet LaPolshim mean? Death to the invaders. That's a strong name for an operation. And the upshot of this operation in the south was basically a stalemate. Yes, the Egyptians lost a lot of men, and the Jews, for the most part, did not. However, the Jews could not create a link up between the vast bulk of the state of Israel and the northern Negev enclave of Jewish settlements. Moreover, they could not break the attachment between the eastern and western wings of the Egyptian invasion. So, in the long run, it was basically a stalemate. But from an Egyptian point of view, they have a problem. Their problem is they're strung out deep into enemy territory with precarious supply lines and troops that don't really want to be there and want to go home. So that was what was happening in the south. What about in the other theaters of war? So Israel had complete initiative in the north against the Syrians and the Iraqis. And they chose to resume the fighting. The goal was to expand the Western Galilee holdings further to the east into Central Galilee and eventually take Nazareth from the Arab Liberation Army, the ALA. If you recall, the ALA was like a Palestinian army that had about 5,000-6,000 soldiers led by Fazi al-Kawukji, a name I won't ask you to remember. All right, now Nazareth fell fairly easily in part because the Druze switched teams. Once they saw that the Jews were going to win, the Druze decided to throw in their lot with the Jewish state of Israel. And that made conquest of Central Galilee a whole lot easier. So Nazareth fell on July 16th, almost without a fight. There was a major question whether to depopulate Nazareth or not. Now, depopulating Nazareth would have meant making refugees out of thousands of Arabs, largely Christian, although some Muslim. And two of the commanders on the scene, Moshe Carmel and Chaim Laskov, the latter would later go on to become chief of staff of the IDF, favored depopulating Nazareth, getting rid of the population, sending them on the road out of the country. However, Ben Dunkelman, who was the Canadian Jewish volunteer who was leading the forces there in Nazareth, he refused. He said, "I'll resign if you make me do that." He was morally opposed to it. Ben-Gurion, in this case, sided with Dunkelman, a rare occasion when Ben-Gurion did not want to see the Arab population dispossessed. Why did he take a Rachmanis approach in this instance? Well, he feared the reaction of the Christian world if the holy Christian city of Nazareth were to be made Christenrein, devoid of all Christian population. So he ordered for the holy places of Christianity to be protected, for the civilian population not to be ousted, and for looting to be banned. And he said, if any of our soldiers start looting, shoot them. Okay, this is tough talk. You know, we don't want any funny business in Nazareth. The upshot of this operation, which was called Operation Dekel, was that the ALA, which was the last significant Palestinian force in the country, was ousted from the former British Mandate Palestine and had to set up their shop in southern Lebanon, shades of what would happen in the decades to come, where southern Lebanon would be a base of Palestinian operations. Okay, now Operation Cyprus was supposed to dislodge the Syrians from their toehold in the country. Remember, from last week, the Syrians invaded Israel and they occupied territory, a swath of territory that was about 3 miles wide east to west, so west of the Jordan River, and about 6 miles north-south. So we're talking 18 square miles, roughly, of territory under Syrian control in the vicinity of Mishmar HaYarden. And the goal was to get them out of the country. Like, you know, the Syrians have no business here. Israel was supposed to be established and to have sovereignty over the Eastern Galilee as per the partition plan. What right do the Syrians have to come and intervene? They don't. So there's going to be some warfare. Well, what happened? Unfortunately, from an Israeli point of view, they underestimated Syrian strength in the region. And Israel only recovered a small portion of that territory. The vast bulk of that territory remained in Syrian hands all the way until the 1949 armistice. And if you know what happens going forward, some of that territory, although it's supposed to be sovereign Israel, remains the demilitarized zone all the way until the Six-Day War, and is a reason why the Six-Day War happens, because of clashes between the farmers and the Syrian artillery in April and May of 1967. Okay, but Israel lost 95 dead, which is very, very bad, and the Syrians lost about twice as much. So it was a bloody battle, didn't accomplish all that much. The main sector where Ben-Gurion was obsessed and feared for the worst, but also wanted the most, was in the central sector. Why? Why this obsession with the central sector against the Jordanians? Well, Jerusalem was still in a precarious position, even with the Burma Road. Remember, the Burma Road was constructed in the first week or so of June and was able to supply civilian supplies to the 100,000 Jewish residents of Jerusalem and able to skirt Jordanian legion artillery, Latrun and Bab al-Wad. So the Burma Road was very important and it saved the city, but it's not good enough. The bottom line is Jerusalem is still not a safe place. So something needed to be done. Well, also the failed battles of Latrun were eating away at the soul of Ben-Gurion. He wanted to avenge that. And Ben-Gurion respected the fighting ability of the Arab Legion and wanted to make sure that he weakened them significantly through armed conflict. Right. Also, there was a political threat. The political threat came from Folke Bernadotte, the UN mediator, the Swedish count, who had his proposal, which we spoke about last time, we'll mention again in a few moments, that would have given Jerusalem over effectively to the Arab state, other than municipal autonomy for the Jews in their parts of the city. So since there is a political threat to Jerusalem, something has to be done militarily in the central sector, or else it'll be Zionism without Zion, and we can't have that. We can't have Zionism without Zion. Okay. Moreover, there is a concern that Ramla and Lida, Ramla and Lod, which are only about 10 miles away from Tel Aviv, are a thorn in the side of the Jewish state, that something had to be done to take that area. But and the airport is in that area. The problem is that Ben-Gurion believed there were 1,500 Jordanian legionnaires defending Ramla and Lod, which would necessitate a major military operation to conquer those cities. As it turned out, Ben-Gurion was completely wrong. Actually, there were only 150 Arab legionnaires in Ramla and Lod, and in fact, John Pasha Glob, the head of the Arab Legion, and King Abdullah had made a conscious decision not to fight for Ramla and Lod, that they would sort of give it up without much of a fuss in order to retain control of Latrun and the rest of the West Bank. But Ben-Gurion didn't know that at the time. He would find it out in short order. Okay, so Abdullah, remember, just wants to hold on to his territorial gains, especially East Jerusalem. He's not interested in an all-out war with Israel. He doesn't want to slaughter all the Jews and commit a genocide. So he has to engage in a phony war against Israel to save face with the other Arab states, but without doing any much real fighting in territory allotted to the Jewish state or even on the periphery. So what ends up happening? Lida falls on July 11th without much of a fuss. The problem is, on July 12th, in a mop-up operation, there was some fighting, some fire, bullets flying from the Arab side on an IDF reconnaissance patrol. And because that happened, the IDF responded with an overwhelming show of force, with grenades and artillery and the whole business, and 250 Arabs died. In the grand scheme of the Israeli-Arab conflict, this is seen as one of the big averas of the Jews. This in Deir Yassin, where innocent people got killed. Okay, but having had the chaos come about, Ben-Gurion decided, you know what? We're going to rid this area of its Arab inhabitants. So in the larger story of the Palestinian exodus and refugee problem, where it is often said that they left of their own accord, and there's a lot of truth to that, when it comes to Ramla and Lod, we're talking about 50,000 Arabs who were shown the door and the highway at the butt of a rifle. This is a rare example, not the only example, but a rare example of post-surrender dispossession of an Arab civilian population, wholesale packing them off in another direction. Where were they told to go? They were told to go march eastward in the direction of Ramallah. In other words, go along the northern ridge of the Jerusalem-Tel Aviv highway in the area still under Arab control from Latrun, Bab al-Wad, towards Ramallah. and there they would find respite, maybe, from their travails. It is claimed that a bunch of people died along the way of thirst and starvation, whatever it is. It was a human tragedy. So if it was a human tragedy, why did Ben-Gurion insist upon it? And why did his commanders not really have much of an objection either? Well, the answer is, and as there are direct quotes to this effect, in war we can't spend time on sentiments. In other words, while we feel bad for these people, we can't afford to feel bad for these people because this area in question absolutely had to come under the sway of the Jewish state. That there was no way Israel could exist as a coastal country with an arm extending eastward towards Jerusalem and be at all safe unless Ramallah and Lod were part of Israel. And Ramallah and Lod could not be part of Israel if they were Arab cities. So therefore, make them non-Arab cities. Make them into Jewish cities. And the airport was there, so you're going to need to have some space in this central part of the country, which is free of a fifth column of Arab residents. Okay. Now, the Mapam would later criticize the government for its inhumane decision. And this is an ongoing issue. The Mapam is just as Zionistic as the Mapai. But they have this soft spot in their heart for the enemy. There's a universal streak in the Mapam. They're Marxists along the line of Soviet thought of universal human brotherhood. So you could argue it's baloney, but there were moments when they were sincere about it. So they have this conflicted personality. Yes, they're avowed Zionists and fighters and ready to kill for the sake of Jewish nationalism, but they don't want to see inhumane excesses, the likes of which the other parties don't worry too much about. Okay, so the Palestinians were on the road, clogging the road towards Ramallah, and this was a good thing from a Jewish point of view because it meant that the Arab Legion did not have easy access on the roadways to get to the front. That you can use human suffering to your military advantage by having people just in a long column, thousands of civilians getting in the way. The Palestinians complained in Amman to King Abdullah that disaster is befalling us and you're not doing enough to help us. John Pasha Glob and Alec Kirkbride, who were the leaders of the Arab Legion, explained that the Palestinians were a bunch of ingrates and didn't appreciate what the Jordanians and the British were doing for them. That the Palestinians hadn't fought well, they had fought very poorly in the Civil War, and now we're just doing nothing. And the Jordanians and British are doing all the fighting, so who are the Palestinians to complain? I mean, the truth is the Palestinians had what to complain about. They're losing a war, they're losing their homeland, and they're becoming refugees. But on the other hand, the Jordanians also have a point. We're doing all the fighting for you and dying for your cause. Although it wasn't really their cause, it was the cause of Jordanian expansionism. Okay, so the Hashemites and the Iraqis, the Jordanians and the Iraqis, the two Hashemite kingdoms, were on the verge of becoming the butt of Arab jokes. And there were accusations that they were in cahoots with the British and with the Jews to give up on the Palestinian cause. Was there any truth to this? There's an element of truth to it in the sense that the Jordanians did allow Israel to come into existence and never really pressed the issue too hard over the course of the war. But in the central sector, between July 13th and the 18th, not much happened. There was basically localized conflict. The IDF didn't realize that the Jordanians were almost out of ammunition, and they were at that point very weak. There was one attempt, and I know everybody always asks, what about the old city of Jerusalem, the Kotel, the Harabait? Was there any attempt made to recover what was lost in the first round of fighting? The answer is yes. There was an attempt made on the old city on July 16th and 17th. After a new ceasefire had been issued by the Security Council, but before it went into effect. So one last ditch attempt to get the holy places. It was done from where Kikar Tzahal is, and it was in the direction of the New Gate, not the Jaffa Gate and not the Dung Gate or the Zion Gate, rather the New Gate. The problem with the New Gate is even if you break through, what are you encountering at that point? Who knows their old city? What happens if you walk into the New Gate today? Where are you? You're in the Christian quarter. You're near the church, the Church of the Holy Sepulchre. So it's not as though this was a Jewish area that was close to historic Jewish attachments. It was just a way of getting a foot into the old city, but it failed. It was the last combined effort of the IDF, the Irgun, and the Lehi, because the Irgun and the Lehi will soon not exist anymore, even in Jerusalem. Okay. So after this failed attempt, David Shealtiel, who was the commander in Jerusalem, was replaced by Moshe Dayan. Why is that relevant? Well, Dayan's career had taken a bit of a turn for the worse, and he lost his eye in the battle in Lebanon in 1941, and he really wasn't doing all that much for a few years. He was eager to get back into some prestigious position in the army, and Ben-Gurion had a soft spot in his heart for Dayan. He made him the Jerusalem commander, which meant that Dayan was responsible, together with Abdullah Tal, for creating the seam line that was the border between East and West Jerusalem for 19 years. Okay, so in the central sector then, to sum it all up, Israel conquered some territory, but it failed to achieve a strategic objective, okay? The UN Security Council on July 15th called for a ceasefire to be in effect on July 18th, with sanctions to be imposed on any party that doesn't willingly participate. So this is a real threat. You know, you gotta stop the war. The UN in Flushing Meadow wants us to stop. Well, the Arabs pretended to oppose the ceasefire and to clamor for war. But the truth of the matter is they were desperate for a truce, lest their ammunition run out and they be overrun completely. So they're pretending, they're talking a big game, we want war, we don't want a ceasefire, but really, secretly, they do want it. What about Israel? So Israel does not want a ceasefire because Israel has more military objectives that have yet to be attained. So there was a kind of a reversal of roles in the second truce as there had been in the first truce. The Arabs desperately want the fighting not to be renewed, and Israel wants war as a means of expelling invaders from the country and to have the Arabs realize that they can be bludgeoned and that they ought to sue for peace. That Ben-Gurion understood you were not going to achieve by diplomacy Arab recognition of the long-term legitimacy of Israel. Maybe they'd sign a ceasefire. Maybe they'd sign an armistice. But the only way the Arab states will have full recognition of Israel, with whatever that entails, diplomatic recognition and the like, would be if they were totally given a bloody nose and bludgeoned and understood that they couldn't defeat the Jews. And since that had not yet happened after the first two rounds of war, Israel needed a third round of war. Okay. So no major battles took place between July 18th and October 15th. So when the second truce went into effect, up until October 15th. The second truce was not of limited duration, meaning the first one was supposed to last 28 days, and it lasted 28 days exactly. The second one was open-ended. It'll come to an end only when there's a sufficient provocation by one side to cause the other side to go to war again, which will eventually happen. But absent that, the truce continues. Okay, so there were a bunch of skirmishes over that three-month period, because each side cheated a little bit. You know, everybody likes to cheat a little bit. But there was no real sustained battle. There were three attempted convoys to the Negev enclave, which were supposed to be allowed under the terms of the truce. But of course, as is the way of the Arab world, even when you make a truce and you allow for the passage of goods for your opponent, you don't allow it. So you know, between 1948 and 1967, were there convoys allowed to Mount Scopus? Not really. Were Jews allowed access to the Kotel? No, even though on paper they were supposed to be allowed. So there were supposed to be convoys to the Negev enclave, and it wasn't allowed. Three times Israel tried to break through, only once was successful. The biggest action, military action, that happened during the Second Truce was the conquest of the Little Triangle. What's the Little Triangle? Well, it's an area south of Haifa, which was a triangle along the coast of Arab villages. And Ben-Gurion and the IDF command had made a decision earlier in the war not to bother expending military resources and risking Israeli soldiers' lives to conquer that triangle because it's an internal problem. It's inside the borders of the Jewish state. And so when they get around to it, it'll be a police action. It won't be a military affair. We'll call it like the Korean War was a police action. Right? So during a truce, you can't go to war with your external enemies, but you could do a cleanup job on the inside. And that's exactly what will happen, that there will be Mivtza Shoter, Operation Police Officer, because after all, this is a police action. And the villagers were expelled, and they were not allowed back. It was something that arguably was unfair, because after all, these people should have been considered citizens of the State of Israel, but in wartime, a lot of ugly things happened. Okay, so like the first truce, the second truce benefited the Jews more than it did the Arabs. Thousands arrived during the second truce to fight for Israel. Machal and Gachal. So mitnadvei chutz la'aretz and giusei chutz la'aretz. Mitnadvim were the volunteers, the giusim were the conscripts. But either way you slice it, these are diaspora Jews who want to fight for the cause of Jewish nationalism. Okay. Well, a decision was reached during the second truce not to allow refugees back during the war. This is an ongoing problem. You know, when there's no fighting for a few months, for 3 months, the civilians who have been suffering in the course of this war, they want to know, well, can I go home? If you were an Arab who was living in Jaffa or Tiberias or Tzfat or Haifa or in the villages of the Jerusalem corridor, and you were ousted or you left before you could be ousted, and now there's a lull in the fighting, you might be very tempted to go back home. Well, who's stopping you? In theory, nobody. And in fact, thousands of Arabs tried to go back home, only to find that Israel, in the course of the truce, would adopt a very tough policy against returnees, that they would be hounded and sent back packing across the front lines, and if they put up a fuss, they'll be shot. So what often happened was people came back to harvest their properties, their land. You know, in the late spring, it's time to reap the grain. So this is their livelihood. They go back to get their produce. And what do they find? Jews are harvesting their grain. So this is going to lead to a clash and possibly gunfire. The big question, though, is will the exiles ever be allowed to return? So it's one thing for the cabinet to vote. As long as there's an ongoing war, the refugees will not return. But what about when the war is over? So the cabinet voted on July 28th, and then again September, to forbid refugees returning outside the context of a general peace agreement. Now, a general peace agreement, I mean, when does that happen? That doesn't happen until Anwar Sadat shows up in 1977. So that's 30 years later, and nobody knows when that's going to happen. Ben-Gurion was somewhat convinced that it'll never happen, that Israel will be a garrison state forever. So with this in mind, it's basically saying, tough noogies, you're not coming home. You're out of here for good. The concern was that the Arabs who return will be a fifth column. There'll be a thorn in the side of the Jewish state from within. And so something has to be done. What are you going to do in order to prevent a return? So one, you can have patrols and reconnaissance looking for people. But the other thing you can do is to destroy the places of Arab habitation so that there's nowhere to return to. And this becomes an important policy that is implemented in the middle 1948, July, August, September, maybe even into October, although Israel would come to regret it, but not necessarily for the reason you're thinking. So while the policy was to destroy buildings and infrastructure during combat, at least initially, it had not been the case that the IDF would destroy things after a battle was over. It was only when the thought was, well, we have to prevent people from returning, that even a week, a month after the conflict has subsided in that region, would the bulldozers come in and destroy things. The Mapam, again, wanting to have its cake and eat it too, objected on moral grounds and said it's one thing to destroy places of Arab residents in the course of an ongoing battle when the bullets are flying. It's quite another to do it 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later. What do you do? It's not fair. It's not right. It's inhumane. It's indecent. Okay, so Ben-Gurion didn't want to hear that, and he thought the Mapam was full of it, and he wanted them to shut up and to not give these moralistic speeches about the welfare of Arab exiles. But there was another factor that resulted in a change of the policy. And what was that? The need for housing. For whom? For Jewish immigrants. Okay? So what's going on here? During the course of the war, Zionism continues. You know, this is a course on Zionism. It's not a course on warfare. What is Zionism? Zionism is the return of the Jewish people to their ancestral homeland, Kibbutz Galuyot and Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. So Yishuv Eretz Yisrael is an important part of the War of Independence. You don't stop building settlements just because the bullets are flying. In fact, that's even more of a reason to establish settlements during the war. So some material resources are shifted away from military production towards creating facts on the ground in border regions and in newly conquered territories. Why does this help? Well, the answer is because civilian infrastructure is sometimes just as good as military infrastructure. Remember, why did the Egyptians not push all the way up to Tel Aviv? Well, because they encountered stiff resistance at Yad Mordechai and Kfar Darom and other settlements. So civilian settlements defended by their own residents with limited weaponry, with the handguns and rifles, that can, when people are really motivated because they don't want to die and have their families overrun, that can be a source of military strength. So making border settlements during wartime was, yes, it was Zionism, but it was also an element of warfare. Okay, so you need to have housing for new Jewish arrivals. All right, the gates of the country are open. Maybe Cyprus isn't open yet because the British are not so cooperative, but the gates of the country are open to immigration. Where are these people going to live? The answer is three different types of places. One is urban housing in formerly Arab neighborhoods of major cities. So we're talking about the formerly Arab areas of Western Jerusalem, the formerly Arab areas of Haifa, of Jaffa, of Tiberias, of Sfat, of Ramla and Lod, all the larger cities that have now empty buildings and empty houses, you're going to put Jews there. So what ought you not do? Don't destroy the building, put Jews there. Because if you destroy the building, we got to build a new one. And that costs money. Okay, where else are the Jews going to go? In the depopulated Arab smaller villages and smaller towns, which had not been mixed cities, but had been entirely Arab. Okay, those populations typically left not at the butt of a rifle, but because they were scared and they ran away. Well, what happened to the properties afterward? So for a few months in the late spring and summer, the policy was destroy everything. Don't let them return. Don't let this be a hideout for Jordanian Legion fighters. But later the policy was, no, leave it standing and put Jews there and have them live there. Eventually, when all that housing stock runs out, there is no choice but to put people where? In Ma'abarot, in transit camps. And I'm sure there is somebody, we have 50 people listening tonight on this class. I'm sure some of you lived in Israel at one point in time. Maybe some of you were alive in Israel back in 1948, 49, 50. And you remember the Ma'abarot. They were a disaster, but they were necessary because there was nowhere else to put people. Okay. The Palestinian Arab refugees had it rough in 1948. Unlike what was expected by Western observers, including James McDonald, who was the High Commissioner of Refugees for the UN and for the League of Nations in the 30s, and was the first ambassador to Israel from the United States, he feared there'd be an epidemic, that there'd be typhus and cholera and bubonic plague, who knows what, that the Palestinian refugees who were living out in the shanty towns were all going to die by the thousands, that there'd be epic starvation and thirst. As it turned out, although they had it very rough, there was no epidemic and there was no major bout of civilian deaths. In fact, as an agricultural people, the Palestinian Arabs, upon being dispossessed and having to live outdoors, fared quite well because they were accustomed to living outdoors. If it had happened to the Jews, who were sort of bourgeois middle-class types, they wouldn't have done as well. Okay. Where did the help come from to feed and house the Palestinian refugees? And why do I care about who paid for it? Well, the answer is because it shows the political alignment and who the friends of the Jews are and who the friends of the other side are. So that's why it's relevant to know these things. Well, it did not come from the Arab states. Other than the Jordanians under King Abdullah, the Arab states did very little for the Palestinian refugees. In fact, their primary contribution was to push in the UN General Assembly Resolution 194 in December of 48, which called for the right of return. But in calling for the right of return, it was primarily geared towards perpetuating the problem, because the right of return in the UN resolution was contingent upon peaceful resolution of the conflict, which the Arab side knew was not forthcoming. So therefore, it means necessarily that the Arab refugee crisis becomes a festering problem, an ongoing problem, and the people become pawns in a bigger political battle. Okay, so who paid for all this stuff? Well, the answer is mostly the aid came from the West. It came from the International Red Cross. It came from the Quakers, but not from the fellow Arabs. Okay, now we get to the important point for Israel's perspective. The truce could not last forever. Why could the truce not last forever? After all, who wants to go back fighting? Well, the answer is Israel can't sustain mobilization for the long haul. I mean, most of the people listening to this class right now are old enough to remember 1967 and the Hamtana, the waiting period from May 15th, 1967 through June 4th. And you'll remember that Israel was on pins and needles and it mobilized its forces on the border with the Sinai. And what happened? Nothing happened for 3 weeks. But something had to happen, because you can't have people, thousands and thousands of men, of fathers and employees and workers, not working, sitting at a border waiting for the rifles to go off. Okay, you can't do this forever. So Ben-Gurion said, if there's a choice between a negotiated settlement involving substantial territorial givebacks or we go to war, he says, let's go to war. I would rather go to war than a settlement with territorial givebacks. So he's a right winger at this point, not a left winger. Well, and if you're going to go to war, what is the purpose of going to war? You expel the enemy from the country. You expel the invaders from the country. But now let's think about that. Expelling the invaders from the country, who's an invader, I ask you? The Egyptians clearly are invaders, which means push them back over the international frontier. The Syrians are clearly invaders. Are the Jordanians really invaders, or are they one and the same with the Palestinian Arabs of the West Bank? It depends how you want to look at it. You could look at it either way. But the point is, if you expel the invaders and the Palestinian Arabs have already been negated as a political entity worth dealing with, then what should be the borders of the state of Israel? The borders should be the old borders of British Mandate Palestine. And what should happen to the Palestinian Arabs? Well, I have no idea. And Ben-Gurion doesn't say. But that's an issue that develops as the war goes on. How much territory do you really want to conquer? Who's the enemy? And at what point do you say enough is enough, because of the demographic factor of this other people are not us. We don't want them in our state. So why should we take the territory in which they are currently located? Also a problem in the year 2020. All right. So sometimes things don't change. Well, so Secretary of State George Marshall, the American Secretary of State, felt that Ben-Gurion was becoming more and more chauvinistic and imperialistic, meaning he sees what Ben-Gurion is saying and doing and thinks that Ben-Gurion wants to expand Israel, an expansionist state, to cover much more territory than was allotted to it. But the question is, even if Ben-Gurion wants to, you got to make a choice where to strike. You can't strike in all places at once. Israel has limited manpower, limited ammunition, limited heavy weapons. Where do you strike? So Ben-Gurion wanted to attack the West Bank so as to safeguard beleaguered Jerusalem and to destroy the Arab Legion. The army, however, wanted to attack Egypt because Egypt threatened Jerusalem from the south. It was the largest Arab army, and they were 20 miles away from Tel Aviv at Ashdod, at Isdud. But there's another wrinkle. So the political leadership wants the West Bank. The army wants an assault on the Egyptian-held territories towards the Negev. But the general public, what does the general public want? The answer is the general public doesn't want to go to war. They thought the war was already over and that the good guys won. You know, we won. We were not annihilated. The Egyptians, the Jordanians, the Syrians, the Iraqis, they didn't kill us all. They hardly overran any of our territory. So let's proclaim victory and go back to work on the kibbutz. What do we have to go to war for again? So it became necessary for the government, for Ben-Gurion, to call the editors of the Hebrew periodical press, and for that matter, the Yiddish periodical press, into a closed-door meeting and to explain to them that they got to write editorial pieces in their papers saying the war isn't over. And you have to rally popular support for a continuation of armed conflict, because we need the general public to be on board with this. If they're not on board, then morale will decline and we might not win. We need to have strong morale and people convinced of the necessity of upcoming military action. Okay, so Israel could not strike until there was an Arab provocation. The trouble was that the political front was heating up, and Count Folke Bernadotte, the UN mediator, was the front man for an American proposal to give a new version of partition, which was not favorable to the Jews. Bernadotte and the Americans understood that partition was a fait accompli. However, instead of it being 55-45 between Palestinian Jews and Palestinian Arabs, creating two separate states, it was between Israeli Jews and Arab states, and the percentage was not 55-45, but something a lot less for the Jews because they weren't going to get the Negev. Israel didn't control the Negev at that point. So this is really bad. But if it's really bad, why are the Americans supporting it? Well, they think it's the most realistic plan, and it reflects the facts on the ground. But if they support it, I ask you a very important political question. Why is this being presented to the general public as a United Nations plan authored by Ralph Bunche and presented by Folke Bernadotte the Swede, when really it's the Americans who are behind it? Why are the Americans hiding their participation in this plan? Why?
They want to lose the Jewish vote.
Why? Oil.
No, the opposite of oil. The opposite of oil.
Sin!
Huh?
Sin!
No. It's that...
Water!
What?
Water?
No. It's the American regime, the Truman administration, does not want to be seen as involved with this because the Democrats want the Jewish vote in November 1948. And if the Bernadotte's plan is seen as insufficiently pro-Jewish because it gives away too much to the Arabs and the Americans are associated with it, then guess what happens? All the people living in Borough Park and Williamsburg vote for the Republicans. And then Dewey defeats Truman. Oy ve. So that's the reason why the Americans are keeping quiet about their involvement in all this. Okay. So Ralph Bunche writes the thing. And it's not even completed. It's 40,000 words. It's like 100 and something pages. I read it last year. It was not especially interesting. The maps are the only thing that matter. And Bernadotte shows up in Israel on September 17th. He flies in from Rhodes, where all the negotiations were happening, and he comes to Israel. And what happens when he gets to Israel? He's assassinated. Okay, within a few hours of his arrival on the scene, he's shot to death in an ambush by four Lehi gunmen. Were the Lehi gunmen ever captured and found and prosecuted for their offense? The answer is Ben-Gurion did not want them caught. Because if they were caught, he'd have a political crisis on his hand of having to prosecute his justice minister, Pinchas Rosen, having to prosecute Jews for killing Folke Bernadotte. So everyone was better served by the assassins getting away with their crime. Bernadotte in the Hebrew periodical press was seen as anti-Zionist and even anti-Semitic. Was that a fair assessment of him? Probably not. During the war, he had saved a lot of people's lives with the white buses and even probably saved a few Jews. So I don't think he was a Jew hater. He just had a plan that wasn't so favorable to Zionist interests. Okay, well, who killed him? So the answer is that the Lehi triumvirate, the leadership of Lehi was Yitzhak Shamir, Natan Yellen Moore, and Yisrael Eldad. They were the troika that ran the Lehi, and they authorized the assassination. But who was on the hit squad? I said we never caught them. Well, we know who the gunman was. His name was Yehoshua Cohen. And Yehoshua Cohen ended up becoming, does anyone know? What ended up happening in two decades later to Yehoshua Cohen?
The spy.
No, that's Eli Cohen.
Eli.
Oh, Eli.
What? Anybody know? So Yoshua Cohen became David Ben-Gurion's personal bodyguard at Stabokir. So here he says, I don't know who killed Folk Bernadotte. Meantime, it's his personal bodyguard in the later years. Okay. So what happened as a result of the assassination of Bernadotte? Something very important happened. So the Irgun and Lehi had been outlawed in the state of Israel upon the establishment of Israel, and a deal was struck with the Irgun in early June, and then there was the Altalena episode. But remember, Jerusalem is not in the state of Israel. It's a separate entity run by a military governor, Dov Yosef. So because Jerusalem wasn't part of the state of Israel, the deal was that Irgun and Lehi could continue to function in Jerusalem without having to worry about being like a separatist dissident group. But after Bernadotte's assassination, that's it. No more Irgun and Lehi, you're finished. So what happens to them? Well, the Irgun becomes the Chayrut party, led by Menachem Begin. They go into politics. I wouldn't call it mainstream politics, but they go into politics. And they run for the Knesset, and they become the third largest party in the first Knesset election. What happens to Lehi? So Lehi basically disappears. It's few hundred fighters get drafted into the IDF, and they sort of blend out of existence. However, from a political perspective, they do continue to exist a little bit, in the sense that in the first Knesset election, they run as the fighters list. The fighters list, Miflegat HaLochamim, and they get one member of Knesset. Natan Yellen Moore is elected to the Knesset. Okay. So what was the long-term significance of Folk Bernadotte's proposal to give the Galilee to the Jews, the Negev to the Arabs, and the West Bank, inclusive of Jerusalem, also to the Jordanians, but with Jewish autonomy in Jewish Jerusalem? So what was the end result of that deal? Clearly, that deal didn't come to pass, because, you know, the borders are not like that at all. However, something very important happened. Because the plan gave the Galilee in its entirety to the Jews, it meant that from a perspective of the next military offensive, it was unnecessary for Israel to fight at first on the northern Syrian front. Because after all, it was already promised, it was vouchsafed that we, the Jews, are going to get the whole Galilee. What's the problem? The problem is that the Goyim want to give the Negev to the Goyim, to the Arabs. So therefore, what do we have to do, we, Israel? We have to go to war against the Negev, against the Egyptians. So if there was a question about which front on which to go to war, that was resolved because of the diplomatic wrangling. So now it's going to be, you got to go to war against the Egyptians. Okay. Well, Farouk secretly negotiated with Israel for a separate peace. Why? He was afraid that the Negev would go to the Jordanians. And he doesn't want that to happen because those are his rivals. Were these negotiations at all serious, or were they a bluff? So we can't know for sure because King Farouk is dead and nobody's here to tell us, but more likely it was a bit of a bluff. It was trying to get Israel distracted from war-making plans to think that there was a possibility of a separate peace with the Egyptians. Now, the cabinet was dilly-dallying. The cabinet doesn't know what to do. Do they go to war against the Egyptians, or do they go to war against the Jordanians? Ben-Gurion is pushing for a war against the Jordanians for the conquest of significant parts, if not all, of the West Bank and certainly of East Jerusalem. The army wants Egypt, okay? Well, there is dilly-dallying at the cabinet level. They take a vote on September 26th whether to attack on the West Bank, and the vote was against the attack by a vote of 7-5. So Ben-Gurion didn't get what he wanted. This is a very rare thing in the history of the War of Independence that David Ben-Gurion did not get from his cabinet authorization for a course of conduct that he thought was essential. Well, what was the pretext for all this? Well, on September 24th, Palestinian irregulars attacked Jews near Modi'in. Now, Modi'in is not far from the Latrun area, and this was seen as a pretext to go to war. It was a provocation, so now we can attack the Jordanian Legion. That's what Ben-Gurion wanted, but the cabinet voted no. So what was Ben-Gurion's reaction? He said, Bechiyala Dorot. What is Bechiyala Dorot?
Crying.
It's a travesty for the generations. In what parsha do we find Bechiyala Dorot? What parsha in the Torah did we just read not long ago?
Shlach.
Bingo. Okay.
Shlach lecha.
Good. Atem b'chitem b'chiyah shel chinam. You cried a cry for nothing when you listened to the Meraglim who said we couldn't conquer Israel. And Hashem says, I'll make you cry Bechila Doros. It is Tisha B'Av. And every year Tisha B'Av will bring bad things for the Jewish people, Chas V'Shalom. So Ben-Gurion is saying, this was like the episode of the Meraglim. We could have had the holy parts of the Holy Land, including the historic parts of Yerushalayim, if only the cabinet had been willing to go forward with it. But they didn't. All right, so it didn't happen. In the end, the war would go southward.
Did he resign? He resigned. There are always a series of resignations. Okay. You know, he's appointed.
Ben-Gurion is constantly threatening to resign.
Yeah.
However, no real resignation takes any effect until 1953. Okay. So with the last minute or two we have left for tonight, let me just explain now what is going to happen next. There is going to have to be a reason to go to war against the Egyptians. You have to find some kind of pretext. And the goal will be to eliminate them from the country completely. Well, the main purpose is to oust the enemy army. However, in the process, the goal will be to take large swaths of territory that are unoccupied by Jew or Arab, but that at one time were vouchsafed to the would-be Jewish state. Remember, the partition plan of 1947 of number 29th gives the vast bulk of the Negev to Israel. Well, if you want it, you got to go take it. There are no Jews there, so you have to do something to send an expeditionary force if you want to make this part of your borders after the war comes to an end. So the war is going to continue in October, November, December, into the first week of January. We're going to spend 2 weeks covering it. But think about it from two different perspectives. One is to defeat the enemy. The other is to take land. You know, you've all been to vacation at Eilat. Okay, you went snorkeling with the dolphins at Eilat.
Well, didn't they have to contend with the Fedayeen at this time also?
Not so much. The Fedayeen will be a problem after the war is over in the early 50s. But if you want to go to Eilat to snorkel with the dolphins, somebody has to take Eilat in the independence. Okay, so see you all next week. Take care.